This is Craft Council from the Craft Council. Conversations with makers about their craft, their challenges, and the ideas that shape their future. For more information, find us via the Craft Council website, www.craftscouncil.org.uk, or on Instagram at Craft Council.
Hello and welcome to Crafts Council from Crafts Council. I'm Anna Fielding.
And I'm Lewis Dalton-Gilbert.
And here with us today, we've got Mark Caulfield-Moore. Hello, Mark.
Hiya.
Mark is, in his own description, a painter who utilises textile techniques. His work has been displayed all over the world, and his 2024 show, We Speak Chicken, was first displayed at Goldsmith CCA before travelling to Norway to appear at the Kunsthaus Stavanger. He's now represented by the gallerist Kate McGarry, and his exhibition Swan Song will be showing in June. Hello, Mark. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Could you tell us where you make all this wonderful work? So what's your studio space like?
So my studio is in a little outbuilding at my boyfriend Auntie's house. She has a little outbuilding in her garden. From out of my window directly, I see a spire of a church. And then to the right, there is a paddock. And then beyond that is some woods. And so it feels very remote, cute, very countrysidey. This is all in a small village called Sedlescombe, which is about 20 minutes away from Hastings, where I live. And what I really love about the studio is that it gives me a sense of isolation in the best possible sense. It makes me feel like the stakes are low because no one's ever going to see it or come across it. There's going to be no footfall or passing traffic. So it really makes me feel that what I make is truly for myself. And I think I had a really big breakthrough when I first moved there with my own work because, yeah, as I said, I started to really make work for and of myself. So using my own memories and life experiences for the first time. And I feel like that's really set me off on a trajectory to this day.
How does it feel showing parts of yourself then to people after being in isolation when you create them?
I think for me, it's important that the works come from a very real place because it gives me a sort of verification in a way that it's coming from a very sort of meaningful place to me, an intimacy that I always strive for. But I think with my own work, even though it depicts sort of very distinct instances, I think to the viewer, they sort of take a while to sort of decipher because I often use a combination of text and image in my work and the text doesn't necessarily correlate with the image and the title does neither of those things. So the meaning is sort of a triangulation between those three things. On one hand, it's exposing and on the other hand, it's not really. But I think what I want viewers to take out of my work is a joy in sharing and a joy in communicating.
I mean, there's a lot of kind of craft skills involved in how you actually produce your work as well. And I wondered if you could tell us about the journey you came towards picking those up.
I first started weaving in the last year of my postgrad at the Royal Academy Schools. And I was doing a lot of silkscreen printing onto fabrics. But I had a tutorial with someone and I was saying, I'm not really happy with silkscreen printing because everything just feels like application onto a surface. It feels like a sort of skin somehow. But then this tutor sort of turned around and was just like, well, you know, there's a whole industry called weaving. And you know, where like the form is embedded within the material itself. And so that sort of launched me into doing a short course in Peckham on a loom for the first time. And then as I was doing my short course, my mum FaceTimed me and I was just like, oh, mum, I'm weaving. And she's like, oh, that's interesting because your grandmother was the weaver in her village. And she sadly died before I was born. But she was just like, and then she had all this innate knowledge sort of like you can get natural dyeing techniques. So you can get green from buffalo dung. And she had all of this knowledge, which she'd never really shared with me before. And
this is your mum.
This is my mum on this FaceTime. And then she was just like, if you're really interested in this, perhaps you should go back to Thailand, stay with your cousins and learn from the local artisans there. And so in the summer before my last year, I went back to Thailand to learn traditional Ikat weaving techniques. And since then, I've sort of modified and made the Ikat technique my own. But it all stems from sort of a real knowledge of how to do proper Ikat.
How was that period of learning Ikat and staying with your cousins?
From a technical, practical point of view, so enriching. But I think what's even more fulfilling is that it connected me to my Thai heritage and my practice taking me back home in a way and connecting with my cousins that I would not have really got to know in the same way. So weaving, not only is it my work, but it's been incredibly personally fulfilling, which is something I couldn't have really anticipated before.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like a really poignant journey. So could you talk a bit more about what craft means to you in light of that?
My term of craft is a prolonged engagement and investigation of a process. And I find that the more you limit yourself, the more open or numerous the possibilities can be. I think I sometimes, when I'm at the studio, sometimes I don't really know what it is that I'm meant to be doing. But because weaving is such a set system of routines and maneuvers, like you have to begin by warping and then you've got the beaming and threading and all of that, by the time you actually get to a decision-making day, you spend so long sort of half thinking about it that you sort of know what you're doing. And so from that, you notice that if you change something, it creates this sort of effect. And from that effect, sort of, I really love Ikat because it creates this sort of distortion, or what I like to call a fizzy heat, where there's sort of a featheriness, or it looks sort of like a digital glitch somehow. But I think from noticing those effects, that's now informed images that I make, or sort of the themes of my work, which are a lot to do with sort of transience and sort of an in-betweenness.
Can you talk about the process of Ikat to people that might not know?
Traditionally, or how I do it?
Bit of both.
So traditionally, you would sort of get your threads and sort of twist them around a bar. And then from there, you would tie dye, so bind a certain image onto the threads that you then submerge in dye. So you're left with sort of a tie-dye image of the thread. And from there, the distortion of Ikat comes from a error of human hand where you can't quite align the image up together. But I found that with traditional Ikat, that only creates a small repeating pattern. So in my work, because I work quite large scale and single images, I like to paint directly onto the warp threads, and it's by winding the threads onto the loom that creates that sort of distortion. I think it's been really important for me to have approached weaving techniques or weaving from an artist or fine art point of view, because I think there's great liberation in being an amateur or being a novice. Sort of, you notice things in certain ways that you wouldn't necessarily.
Who else do you admire as a maker and an artist?
I really admire artists that have created their own language in a way. So I'm thinking of people such as Rose Wiley, Forrest Bess, and perhaps a more obscure artist called Frank Jones. I think you would call him a sort of self-taught artist in the 20th century. In the 60s, he began to do these incredible drawings from prison because he was incarcerated or serving a lifetime sentence for murder for something, but he always denied that. But he only used red and blue pencils and discarded accountancy paper, which is what he found in sort of the trash can of the prison office, which is where he worked. Because I believe he was born with a slight defect that that he couldn't see properly out of his left eye. He grew up with the belief that he, I think he called it a veil, in which he, the living and spiritual realms were really close together. So he always had visions of sort of ghosts or spirits. So all of his drawings look like these houses, which within them have sort of these cell room type structures with sort of little devils in them. And obviously Forrest Best was a fisherman and part-time painter, but he would draw his dreams or visions. And Rose Wiley, as we all know, sort of draws very much from her everyday life. And I think what I'm drawn to by all these artists is their perspective or their way of seeing things. And I don't think you can sort of fake an intimacy, or you can fake seeing a work that you know really means something to the maker. And with my own work, because it draws on personal memories, which might not necessarily other people would know what I'm talking about, I would hope that there is an innate logic that's still at play.
And when you're creating these personal works, what tool could you not live without?
A bit of an easy answer, but probably my loom.
That makes a lot of sense in context.
But I think the loom is special because I think it's both a teacher and a time machine. And I will explain why. I think it's a teacher because, as I said before, it's such a routine-based process that it tells me what comes next. It tells me what's next in the pattern, what's next in the sequence. So it puts me to work, really, and it guides me. And in terms of it being a sort of time machine, the process of weaving hasn't really changed for thousands of years. It's still the lifting up of warp and weft in different systems to create a pattern. So I think it connects me to past weavers and to my grandma, who I'd never met. So I feel like those threads span miles and years as I'm working away in East Sussex. Mm.
Do you have any examples of your grandmother's work?
No, I don't. No, I've never seen any. I mean, I think when my mum said she was the weaver in her village, I think they grew up quite poor, and in the countryside, I think it was just seen as an essential task in order to have clothes, you know, to be able to make your own skirts or something like that. I don't think it was probably seen as very much a creative or artistic production, but a sort of necessarily quotidian one. Mm.
Very practical.
Exactly.
Very rooted in what was needed.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah.
Are there any obstacles that are currently in the way for you?
I think I talked about the freedom in being an amateur, or the freedom in being a novice, sort of approaching things with a fresh set of eyes. I'm sort of really drawn to people that try and break convention in a way. So I'm really struggling through reading the poetry of Gertrude Stein at the moment. I don't know if you've read Tender Buttons, but it's mad. Like yesterday, what did she say? She said, "A salad, it is a winning cake." I'm like, that's amazing. But also, what does that mean? But I think...
And kind of interesting is her wife was such a famous cook as well.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And food is a big part of my practice, because I believe that food is another form of communication and love, and sort of we speak, yet we ingest food with our mouths, and all those sort of connections. But I think with Gertrude Stein, I think anything that breaks with convention, anything that sort of makes you focus on the sensory or linguistic quality of words rather than sort of a traditional understanding, I think anything that sort of liberates you and makes you feel playful or experimental is something that's really useful in sort of broadening your own horizons as an artist. And so works that sort of, yeah, things that's really challenging me at the moment. But then I think it's really helping me, because I've been saying I'm a painter for years, but I've actually never oil painted. So went to the National Gallery a few weeks ago, and then afterwards I went to CasArt, and I was just like, okay, what would an oil painter do? So I sort of bought oil paint, and I'm like, oh, this is painting. And then I got back to my studio and sort of, I've never sort of squeezed paint out of a tube, and I'm sort of like, oh, I guess this is painting as well. And sort of, I'm really interested by impasto, which is sort of, you know, that really thick glob of oil paint that sits on a surface. And I think coming now, looking at it from quite a textile perspective, it feels almost like a brooch on a textile, or it feels like it could be an embroidery or an embellishment on a surface. So I don't know.
Is it that texture?
Is that texture?
That seems to be a commonality across a lot of what you do.
Exactly. Is that texture? Is that body? I'm obsessed with like surface and skin. And I think weaving is a creation of a surface. So one thing I found out, which I didn't know before, was that silk shines not because of the shiny material of silk thread, but rather there's a certain specific sequence of how you weave silk that allows for longer threads so that when light shines on it, it doesn't scatter. Usually like a plain weave, you know, it goes in, out, but with silk weave, you leave those threads much longer. So there's that sort of glistening luster effect when light hits it.
So really it's just physics.
Really, it's just physics.
We learn, you every day is a learning day.
You kind of just touched on this with your endeavours into oil painting. But if you could master any other craft, what would it be and why?
I think I would love to learn pattern cutting. I would love to learn upholstery. I think I would love to, even though my textiles are artworks, I would love to sort of push them further into a further use somehow. And I don't know whether it's me, but I feel that our contemporary world sometimes lacks quality or soul. And I would just love to be able to sort of make my own clothes in a way, or imbue the objects that I wear or have around me with more feeling.
I could see that collection. Heard it here first.
And actually, we've kind of touched on this one as well, talking about the silk, but letting your imagination go wild for a moment, if time and money and the laws of physics were no object, what would you love to make?
I think the history of fabrics and textiles is one that is essentially quite nomadic. I mean, I think of, as well as clothes, which are a stand-in for people and sort of migration and our daily sort of contact with it, I think also of tents and rugs. I would love my fabrics to take me places, literally. So I would love to maybe create sails for a boat. I mean, even though my practice has taken me all over with shows, I would love to sort of make something physical that could take me from one place to the next. So yeah, a sails for a boat, or maybe, I mean, I'm glad that physics isn't a requirement, but maybe a hot air balloon to make textiles for a hot air balloon.
That's a good one.
That's a good answer. I immediately thought of a magic carpet, but I don't know.
So did I. I thought a magic.
Can I make a magic? Well, yeah.
You can make a magic carpet. You should make a magic carpet.
That's a much better answer.
I'm about this close to breaking into a whole new world. hot air balloons and magic carpets. I love this. This is a novel waiting to happen, isn't it?
And when you were talking to your mum about weaving, did she give you any advice, or do you have any advice for fellow makers that you can share out there?
Her advice to me has always just been, do whatever makes you happy, which I think is just great advice for everyone. But I think a tutor once told me that making is a form of thinking. And so I think my biggest advice for other makers is to just start, is to just begin. I think we so often procrastinate and talk ourselves out of ideas before we've even started. And I just feel like that first hurdle of actually beginning something is the hardest. But once you have something to touch or to hold or to respond to, that whole process of creating gets so much easier as you go down the line. So yeah, just start.
And that is a great place to stop. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark.
Thank you for listening to Crafts Council from Crafts Council. For more craft stories and inspiration, go to the Crafts Council website, www.craftscouncil.org.uk.